Hello, you're listening to On The Point, the news collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM, I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Caitlin Fung.
And I'm Maddie Delplane. It's Saturday, February 27th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today we're talking to a local artist, Pearl Lowe, about Barbara Howard Plaza and how honoring Black life in Vancouver looks like now, as well as how it should look.
We also speak to Kendra Milne, Executive Director of Health Justice, about the Provincial Mental Health Act. She talks about the desperately needed updates to mental health legislation and the impact these policies have on those living with mental illness in the province.
But first, we have our piece about Barbara Howard Plaza, which is quite hefty. Caitlin, can you set it up for us?
A few weeks ago, a local artist named Pearl Lowe tweeted about the plaza for Black History and Black Future Month. The plaza is named after Barbara Howard, a Black woman from Vancouver who made achievements for being the first woman of color in her field throughout her athletic and education career. Pearl brought up some important points about the plaza's design, including how easy it is to miss that it's actually dedicated to Barbara Howard and why that's a problem. She says it epitomizes how the city treats its Black community.
All right, let's have a listen.
The building behind me is Strathcona School. And if you were a student here in the 1950s, or if your parents or grandparents were, the gym teacher here was one of the fastest women in the world. Her name was Barbara Howard, and even at a young age, she was known for speed. She was always first pick for relay.
How do we celebrate Black life in our cities? As we near the end of Black History Month, also called Black Future Month, it's a question that many will continue to reflect upon. In Vancouver, Black people represent just 1% of the population, but are subject to disproportionately higher rates of unemployment, homelessness, and street checks. Given these disparities, celebrating Black life is an important yet complicated undertaking for the city of Vancouver. One of the most famous Black Vancouverites to be recognized by the city is Barbara Howard. She was the first Black woman athlete to represent Canada in international competition. In 2018, the city renamed a plaza after her. But does it really honor her and live up to her memory? We wanted to find out.
Here I am at Barbara Howard Plaza. It is raining. I think it's slowly reducing a little, but it is still raining. Here in Vancouver, it's the 21st February 2021. And we're here to talk about Barbara Howard Plaza and the city of Vancouver's treatment of it. So, what is this? This is West 6th coming off the ramp to the Cambie Bridge, very near the Broadway City Hall SkyTrain station. And here we are, Barbara Howard Plaza, and this was built in a long time ago. I believe this was called the Cambie Street Plaza. That's just what it's called. It's Cambie Street Plaza, which was renamed Barbara Howard Plaza in 2018 to commemorate, you know, the first Black female athlete to ever represent Canada internationally, as well as the first person of color ever hired in a Vancouver school board school, which is the Strathcona School. I think the plaza itself, for what it is, obviously the plaque that commemorates it as being named after Barbara Howard is actually tucked off to a corner. What is the main centerpiece of the plaza is this large metal sculpture of a rocket called the Centennial Rocket. And that was a replica of a rocket that was built for the Pacific National Exhibition Raid in 1936, and this was built to commemorate the Vancouver Expo in 1986. So right opposite the Olympic Village Station, the rocket catches your eye more than the rest of the plaza in many ways. And in fact, the plaque that says Barbara Howard Plaza is blocked by hedges as the traffic approaches on the right-hand side of the road here, the opposite side of street from Olympic Village Station. You can't really, the Barbara Hoover Plaza text itself is blocked out. And it's also on an incline from the street level. It's a very interesting sort of scene here. And actually there are some fantastic Canada geese to the right. I got some audio of two of them flying off. As you look at the plaque that commemorates Barbara Hoover Plaza, you see a huge Vancouver police station right in the background, and then there are some apartments and condos, and of course the Cambie Street Bridge, which is, this is directly to the back of. And if you look at it from the left, you see all of downtown, you can see the observation towers, you can see all of the condos that lead you to downtown. So there's a certain level of incongruousness about this. There's a certain level of, this was square peg into a round hole sort of thing. Because we talk about it in the interview, but Cambie Street itself, and, you know, West 6th and Cambie, didn't mean a whole lot to Barbara Howard. Because I think the main thing about her was she taught at Strathcona School, which is close to here, but not exactly in the same neighborhood. But yes, all right. So that's me here. I'm going to get out of the rain and wait for Caitlin.
Earlier this month on Twitter, local artist Pearl Lowe highlighted how the plaza doesn't truly live up to Barbara's legacy. Many people have never even noticed it. We caught up with Pearl at the plaza to ask her more about Barbara and how the space currently represents her.
Hi, I'm Pearl Lowe. I am a storyboard artist, illustrator, and comics artist, as well as a new muralist. And I primarily work in animation for TV and film for kids' content. Based in Vancouver, BC, but I also have clients in LA. I've worked on feature films such as Hair Love, Canvas, which is now on Netflix, and television shows such as Craig of the Creep from Cartoon Network. I currently am also making some comics with Scholastic, and I'm readapting the series The Adventures of the Bailey School Kids into graphic novel form. So Barbara Howard Plaza is a very centrally located plaza, and to be honest, I worked around here for years and I didn't know that it was dedicated to somebody until I was having bubble tea at Paragon, and I wandered over here because I wanted to take a seat and sip on my bubble tea, and my partner saw this plaque and a sign with the name of Barbara Howard Plaza in the corner, at the very edge, and so that's how I found out about the name of this place. And who it was dedicated to. Barbara Howard was definitely an icon. She helped back when the British Empire Games was a thing. She brought home bronze medals for us in some track relays. But she was also a teacher in the Strathcona area, which is really rad. And she was just a really, really lovely person. There's some other folks in the community who have gotten to meet her. She was a really lovely person. I think she passed in 2017, somewhere around there. But yeah, she's just a really cool icon. And I wouldn't have known about the space if I didn't accidentally look towards the ground to see what was written. But yeah, that's how I found out about this place.
Did you know about Barbara Howard before seeing this plaza?
I did not know about her before. I think this was my very first introduction to her. And it was really cool. The write-up itself, her biography, was very impressive. And I thought, well, this is such an iconic Vancouverite. Why shouldn't we, you know, be talking about her a little bit more? Especially when a whole plaza was dedicated to her. I just felt it was really interesting that she wasn't actually highlighted, even though she has a whole plaza named after her.
And seeing this plaza and seeing that it's named after her, do you think, it reflects her at all?
I think that it does not reflect anybody, really. If you're trying to highlight somebody, they're usually cool. And usually they have so many cool things to talk about that they've achieved in their lives. And this place is a very low-key plaza. The colors are very gray. The sign for Barbara Howard Plaza is very close to the ground. So I don't personally think that it represents her cool achievements of, you know, going abroad to Australia, winning medals, being a really, really cool teacher, teaching kids from all different backgrounds. I think that this place could be so much more lively, so much more colorful, and obviously so much more outstanding, just to reflect her personality and her achievements.
What do you see here instead when you're looking at this plaza?
Mm-hmm. So, well, currently or?
Currently first.
Currently I see a very industrial looking kind of plaza. It is very centrally located, but my attention goes to the rocket right here, the Centennial rocket. And I thought that was the point of the plaza. I thought it was to dedicate it to this scientific achievement. But actually it's not. So that's what I noticed first. I also noticed that it doesn't really seem like a place for people to actually socialize. I think that it is just a very poorly thought out design. There aren't any benches, there aren't any garbage cans. People can't really actually be in this space. I just feel like it's a space to pass through.
We asked Pearl to take us through the plaza, showing us how anyone passing through the space would generally experience it.
So, take it away.
Okay. So right now we're at the entrance of Barbara Howard Plaza, and right at the entrance, the first thing that I see is the Vancouver Transportation Club insignia with the rocket statue right in the middle. So my first experience here was walking straight through and wanting to read about the rocket, and because at this angle you don't really see a plaque onto the rocket statue, I tend to just walk around and look at the backside of it. And then in doing that, my first thought was, oh, okay, I guess this is what the plaza is dedicated to, is this transportation club. But after turning around, I saw more metal plaques towards the back end of the plaza. So I would walk a little bit closer, and the font is very small, so you have to kind of walk right up to it, and it's very close to the ground as well. So I would read the plaque, and the first time that I did read it, I was very surprised. I was like, oh my gosh, this is dedicated to a Black Vancouver. This is so cool. And then to the left of the plaque is the name of the actual plaza. And at that point, I was very surprised, just because the hedge was blocking my view. So from the entrance of the plaza, I didn't know the name. That's why I assumed it was the Transportation Club's plaza. And the plaque is also very small, gray, and very close to the ground. So I couldn't see it from the other end, really. And generally speaking, I don't spend time sitting here. I don't really actually walk through here either. There's a bubble tea shop nearby that I do get bubble tea at, and sometimes maybe I sit on one of the concrete, you know, slabs here, but usually I don't really explore the field. I don't really sit on any of the ledges here. I just kind of walk through and continue on to wherever I'm going. So it's not a very big plaza, but also I feel like the flow of the plaza doesn't really take you anywhere. You know, the plaque is at the very end of the plaza, the rocket is in the middle, so it kind of makes you just do a straight line on the left-hand side. But there's no real exploration that I feel like I've done on the right-hand side, because there's not really anything. So that's my initial, those were my initial impressions of the plaza, and that's kind of the flow that I continue to do. I don't really stay here and explore the right-hand side or anything. I just kind of stay towards the left, closer to traffic, and kind of keep it moving.
According to Pearl, the city should be doing more to honor its Black community. Having dedicated spaces like Barbara Howard Plaza is a good start, but the city's efforts need to go further given its existing track record.
I don't foresee the city, just because of their history of how they tend to move with the Black community, I haven't really seen any actual proactive, just action being towards, yeah, taking a stance and trying to change the space. So, yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about kind of like the history of the city's lack of action in terms of, like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I just think that the city, you know, especially with the biggest example, Hogan's Alley, that was purposely, you know, kind of built through with the Georgia Viaduct, We no longer have space to congregate or to hang out as a Black community, and you know, people with different cultures, like even the Croatians, they have a whole cultural center that they can at least like gather, but with Black Vancouverites, we don't have any place like that. And we brought this up to the city being like, hey, we would really like to have this kind of land back so we can come together as a community, because being physically dispersed really does change how the community evolves, you know, and how Vancouverites even think about Black Vancouverites, if there's a community at all. Some people think that Black Vancouverites don't even exist. So I think that with the very slow action towards, you know, Hogan's Alley revitalization and kind of reimagining, and also actions like these on an everyday basis, you know, not really taking consideration to listen to people from the Black community about concerns they have about public spaces that, you know, honestly, everyone will benefit. No matter what the situation is, even though it's very Black specifically, people will benefit from, you know, this being an elevated space. So I just think that not really prioritizing my voice in this just kind of echoes how they've treated Black Vancouverites in general, just kind of, you know, pushing things aside, being like, okay, this is not a priority. And I really think that, I don't know, obviously I'm an artist, and I really think that art in public space is a priority just because it shapes the culture of your city and how people interact and all that stuff. So I feel like that is a really huge priority. I mean, you spend money in this space, why don't you make it, you know, nice and enjoyable and impactful? There's no point in having a space that doesn't do anything, in my opinion. It's just kind of a waste of money. So I feel like if you're gonna do something cool, you know, go out. It doesn't have to be expensive, you know, it doesn't have to be complicated. I think it just has to make sense. But that starts with, you know, getting feedback from the community and like listening to us. But so far that hasn't happened, as I've already seen. But yeah, that's kind of how my relationship is with the Vancouver government, you know, relation to the Black community.
As we look to the future and beyond Black Future Month, we asked Pearl to share her vision for a plaza that would truly celebrate Barbara Howard's legacy. Finally, we asked her to take us through her thoughts on why more needs to be done to honor Black communities and life in Vancouver.
Yeah, I see Barbara Howard Plaza in such a more playful way. I really do see, I guess just because I've recently done a mural and I've really personally experienced how it feels to transform space with paint on, you know, public property. I really think that painting the pavement, the walkways, even the bike lanes surrounding Barbara Howard Plaza would be such a nice border to kind of draw your eye to the attention of this space. I also see a really splotchy grass area, and I really think that that could be better taken care of, but it could also have maybe more flowers, or have at the very top towards the bridge, I guess, you could have Barbara Howard Plaza kind of elevated as a sign. So when you drive by, when you walk by, when you bike by, you can actually see it, just because right now there are a few hedges, which are very, very low, about like knee height for me, 5'7". and it covers the name Barbara Howard Plaza. So I would love to see that name elevated so people can see it from all different angles. And plus, if you want to go up there and read her plaque, once you turn around, I think it would be a really nice view of the whole entire plaza, you know? I would like to see more benches. I would like to see more recycling cans and like different ways to dispose of your waste, just to keep people responsible and, you know, kind of encourage people that, and give a signal to people that, oh, you can sit here and you can eat, you can have lunch, you can do whatever, and there's a place to put your waste. As well, I want to see more thoughtful kind of, even if I ask for benches, like I really would like to see the benches positioned in a way where the view is optimal from where you sit. Because if you just put a bench and it's facing the rocket, it's obscuring a view, like it's not really nice. But if you put a bench and it's kind of facing towards Olympic Village Station a little bit, you see the city skyline. If you point it towards Gravel Island area, towards Ash Street, like you can kind of see down that way. Or even on this patchy grass, if you put seating up there, you would get a more elevated view, more of the city too. So yeah, I see Barbara Howard Plaza definitely being more colorful to kind of reflect her being a teacher. I mean, she was a kids teacher. I would like to see some color. I feel like she was a very, elementary school teachers are very lively, so I feel like that would be nice to see. and as well as like, yeah, just some patterns that really reflect the Black experience, perhaps some indigenous designs too, that would be really cool. But yeah, that's how I see the space transform.
And when people are here, how do you want them to feel, or what do you want them to be thinking about?
I want them to feel like, wow, what a cool piece of, how can I say? I really think that parks are experiences, or plazas are experiences. And so being in the middle of the city, I still want people to feel that energy, you know, cars are passing by, downtown's right there, you know, same thing with, what do you call this, Canby Village? Canby Village is right behind you, like you're in the middle of everything. But I also want you to feel like a cool sense of just like being a part of like art and being a part of a little bit of nature too. Because I mean, even though we're bypassing cars, it can be quiet at times. So I really think that it would be really cool to be like, oh, look, we're in a little tiny piece of oasis, like right directly in the middle of the city. So that would be a cool vibe.
And if Barbara Howard was still alive today, what do you think she might want to add to this space?
Maybe she would want to add either exercise section. I don't know if she would, as an athlete, if she would appreciate that, or an area for children to specifically play. I know this area has a lot of businesses. But also adults can play on the playground too, so I think that would be beneficial for everybody. And I do feel like she would be up for color. I feel like as Black people, we have so many cool cultures that we come from, and a lot of that has to do with color, you know, color expression. So I definitely feel like she would enjoy that. Send a really strong signal that Vancouver is more committed to talking about different types of cool Vancouverites in this city to represent, you know, our city and our culture. I definitely know more about Terry Fox than Barbara Howard, and I think that's an issue. I know he's not from Vancouver, but you know, we know so much about him, and he was taught about in schools, etc. So I really think that having something that's so outstanding that you can't look away, and you want to not look away just because it's so pretty here, you know, there would be color, there would be like beautiful flowers, that kind of thing, would just show visually, like, look how much care is put into this space. This is how much care we have towards the Black community and towards Barbara Howard and her achievements and what she's done for the city. And it definitely gives more visibility too to the existing residents of Vancouver who are Black. I don't know anyone who I've talked to personally knew that this plaza was dedicated to Barbara Howard, who was Black. And after, you know, kind of putting it out there on Twitter, a few Black folks reached out to me being like, oh my gosh, I wish I knew. I would have spent more time here, even if it's kind of, you know, not as exciting as it could be. You know, we still want to celebrate, you know, someone who represents us in one way, and celebrate that just because we don't get, you know, that recognition. So, that's how I feel.
This story was produced by Akshay Kulkarni and Caitlin Fung on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Editing was done by Akshay Kulkarni, and special thanks to Pearl Lowe for sharing her thoughts on Barbara Howard Plaza and what cities like Vancouver should be doing to honor Black communities.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
And welcome back to On The Point by CITR 101.9 FM. This is your source of alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And you just heard mine and Caitlin's piece about Barbara Howard Plaza and our audio tour with Pearl Lowe.
Just as an update, Pearl has brought her points about the plaza to the attention of the City of Vancouver, but only got a reply from their horticultural department. The response only focused on her comments about a hedge in the plaza, which blocks the view of a plaque that actually recognizes Barbara. The city now plans to remove the hedge and replace it with grass, but it doesn't really address the fact that they need to meaningfully uplift the Black community in Vancouver.
Yeah, it's a very much a individual act to a systemic problem, which is something we see a lot, but let's see how this all shakes out. So, all right, let's get to the next interview, which is about the Provincial Health Act, and it's with Kendra Milne. Maddie, could you tell us more about your interview?
Yeah, so throughout the last year, we've been hearing a lot about all the compounding crises happening across the country right now. So there's the COVID-19 pandemic, the toxic drug supply crisis, and now a growing mental health crisis. The Representative for Children and Youths Detained report came out earlier this year and exposed the dramatic increase in involuntary apprehensions under the BC Mental Health Act, just across the board, but particularly among youth. We've also seen this intersecting with headlines lately about like the hike in wellness checks done by police in the province in 2020.
Yeah, and that all of that, obviously, just the compounding effects on all of us can't really be understated. And we had an interview a few weeks ago with Meenakshi Mano about these things also. But what does that interviewee today have to say about it?
Yeah, so I wanted to speak with Kendra at Health Justice and learn a little bit more about what can be done to address some of the major human rights violations that are taking place within BC's mental health system.
Sounds interesting. So let's take a listen.
Cool. So yeah, just to get started, can you just tell our listeners what your name is, what you do, and your preferred pronouns?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Kendra Milne. I'm the executive director at Health Justice, and my pronouns are she, her, hers, or they, them, theirs.
Great. And just sort of as a general overview, can you just tell me a little bit about basically the work that Health Justice does?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Health Justice is a relatively new nonprofit and charity. And we work province-wide in BC to improve compliance and support for human rights principles in coercive healthcare. And we started with a three-year project that's focused on reforming the Mental Health Act in BC to improve support for human rights and health outcomes related to involuntary treatment under that act.
But what exactly is coercive healthcare and what does that look like in BC?
Yeah, so everyone, both internationally from a human rights perspective and under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada, it's part of our fundamental human rights that we essentially get autonomy and self-determination over what happens to our own bodies when it comes to healthcare. So it's fundamentally about, you know, we get to decide what treatment we want or don't want, and we have a right to information about the pros and cons to treatment. And that's really like a fundamental part of our dignity and ourselves that we get to control those things. And coercive healthcare is any time that parts of those rights are eroded. So that can be anything from, you know, not being offered a full spectrum of services. So you're only being offered sort of a really narrow set of choices. Your choices are limited. To kind of indirect pressure to make certain choices about your healthcare, all the way through to what we focus on, which is legally involuntary treatment. So it's where the state actually has the ability and legal authority to detain you and to give you medical treatment without your consent.
Okay. And then I guess sort of touching on something that happened a couple months ago, I noticed there was a Statistics like Canada report that has showed that there were apprehensions under the Mental Health Act were up by like 12% or something in 2020, like just across the country, specifically apprehensions by police. And then I think maybe around the same couple weeks, the Representative for Children and Youth also released its detained report. And that also just showed like this huge leap in youth apprehensions under the Mental Health Act. Can you explain a little bit about why we're seeing such a significant increase in involuntary apprehensions?
I mean, I can do my best based on what we're hearing in community and from people being impacted. I think one of the challenges in BC is we don't have a lot of data, so it's actually kind of hard to know what's happening. And so we kind of see the downstream impacts of what I think are system failures, but we don't have a lot of data to really understand what's happening within the system. But certainly there's been really widespread documentation of increased police involvement in mental health crises, whether that's through what's called often kind of informally wellness checks or Mental Health Act apprehensions, where the police have the ability to apprehend you and take you to the hospital for an assessment, through to the use of involuntary treatment under the Mental Health Act. And so the rates of use of involuntary treatment have gone up drastically for everyone across age spectrums. But we've particularly seen this huge, in the last 10 years, about 162% increase in the use of involuntary treatment for children and youth in BC. And I think the way we understand the root cause of that is a real failure to invest in adequate voluntary supports and community. So we hear a lot from people that they're, if they need supports or someone they love or in their lives need supports, it's really, really challenging to find, access to specialists, access to free or low-cost counseling services and the kinds of supports we might need. And when we don't have that, people either don't have access to the supports they need, so their health declines and declines and declines until they may need sort of acute and crisis-based care in the hospital. Or that's just where folks are ending up to access any type of care. So we're kind of seeing involuntary treatment be used for people who don't actually need it because they could be accessing voluntary services, but those services aren't there. Or for people who may meet the legal criteria for involuntary treatment, but we could have intervened much earlier in their lives and in to meet their needs in a way that could have avoided involuntary treatment.
Absolutely. And I guess sort of, and this is another really big question, so my apologies for if it's a little unwieldy, but there's been a considerable discussion this year sort of around like the compounding crises of the COVID-19 pandemic and obviously the ongoing like toxic drug supply crisis. And now this like what seems to be expanding mental health crisis in sort of the midst of all of this. What would you say like have been sort of the impacts that the COVID-19 pandemic has had on mental health care in BC?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been, I think more and more research, and I'm not necessarily an expert in this area, but I think more and more research is showing us that folks who already had, were accessing mental health services or had mental health diagnoses within the system, are the ones who are really bearing the brunt of the consequences of both of those things, right? And so we know that everyone can experience an overdose, we know they're disproportionately impacted by low-income, racialized, Indigenous, Black communities, and we know that that's the same for consequences from COVID. And I think where we see those two things align is that the folks that were not able to access equitable services before, that's only heightened. So I think we very much see that COVID is not creating new inequities in access to service. It's sort of exacerbating ones that were already there and magnifying them, and the consequences are much, much bigger for folks. So folks that weren't getting their needs met before are experiencing that just in an incredibly magnified way. And then the other part of it is there in BC, the use of involuntary treatment, there's a lot of documentation about the need for increased transparency and accountability about how it's being used, because there's been reports called like a report on it was called Operating in Darkness, and that's very much how it feels. There's not a lot of transparency about what's happening within the system when people are detained, and I think COVID has really exacerbated that, because visitors and external folks are no longer allowed on psychiatric wards, or there may be restrictions in visitors. And so what's happening on those wards, and how tools like seclusion rooms and restraints that are used within the involuntary system, how those are being used. Again, there's this heightened level of kind of lack of transparency.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you touched on this a bit already. And I know that there wasn't any real, I think, specific data regarding race in the detained report. But yeah, can you just like expand a bit more on what you think that sort of these increases in apprehensions under the Mental Health Act could mean specifically for like Indigenous youth living in Vancouver?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, we know, so while BC doesn't have publicly available data on indigeneity or on race and ethnicity for folks that are experiencing involuntary care, we know from other jurisdictions that have similar colonial histories, like Australia and New Zealand, involuntary treatment can absolutely be a tool of systemic racism. So other jurisdictions see Indigenous folks in their community are more likely to experience involuntary treatment, they're more likely to be detained, And then there are really big jumps in kind of the level of coercion used on them. So they're much more likely to experience things like physical and mechanical restraints or being put in seclusion rooms. And so we know that that's a tool of state power that I think can and is very likely becoming an avenue for systemic racism. And we saw in Dr. Tripel Lafon's report in Plain Sight on racism in BC's healthcare system, there was more than one anecdote in that report that were related to Indigenous people's experience of trying to access physical healthcare, often totally disconnected from mental health needs, and the system responding with sort of clear evidence of systemic racism and reading their needs through really discriminatory biases about Indigenous people, and actually detaining them for psychiatric reasons when they had no mental health issues happening. So I think, we're a settler organization, so I don't want to speak on behalf of Indigenous people or communities, but I think very much we hear in our engagement with Indigenous folks that the health system and involuntary treatment and apprehensions can be part of a spectrum of kind of state power, and really a colonial tool that kind of continues this feeling of like institutionalization and controlling of people and communities that feels for folks very connected to the criminal justice world and child welfare. And it's sort of another way that a state institution can intervene in a really paternalistic way and sort of enact some of those dynamics of colonialism and racism.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, something that you touched on a bit before, but I guess from Health Justice's view, like what are some of the biggest issues with the BC Mental Health Act and what are you really pushing to see addressed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're part of our model is to do quite deep community engagement. And so we're co-led by a group of folks with lived experience of involuntary treatment and an Indigenous leadership group. So part of the sort of specifics of what we're recommending are being co-developed with those groups. But I would say we know sort of the big buckets of priorities under the Act. So the biggest thing I think is the Act in BC has not been changed since the late 1990s. And we've made, there's been huge strides in how we approach mental health care. And there's aspects of the Act that are actually remain essentially unchanged from its original version in the 1960s. I think when you hear them, you see the way we thought about mental health in the 1960s really echoed in the Act. So for example, the Act allows staff at detaining facilities to provide discipline. It actually says the words discipline to folks that are detained involuntarily under the Act. And I don't think we would accept that as part of any other healthcare. Like I think it really reflects deep and archaic stereotypes about people experiencing mental health issues. And that is essentially the ability to discipline patients essentially authorizes unrestricted use of things like mechanical restraints and seclusion rooms, where other, if you're in youth detention in BC or if you're in adult guardianship or assisted living, there are legislated restrictions about when those kinds of tools can be used and real robust safeguards about, how long can things like a seclusion room be used for? When can it be used? What's the process that needs to be followed? Because it's an incredibly serious tool to be using. And we don't have anything like that in BC's Act. So that's an example of something that I think we need to be having increased conversations about transparency about, and sort of we can legislate ways to reduce the use of those tools that we know are harmful and to provide safeguards to make sure that they're not being abused. Another example of something that we're working on is, we hear from many, many folks in the system that families or loved ones often feel really disconnected and like they don't have information about what's happening to the person and their what's happening to the person who's accessing services. And we know that trusting personal relationships in our lives are like a key driver of our mental health and recovery when we're experiencing illness. And the Mental Health Act actually removes the ability for your loved ones to be involved in your care. So if you're getting any other type of health care in BC, you have all sorts of rights. So you are presumed to be capable of consenting to treatment. If you can't consent to treatment, then there's a whole system in place where, you know, some people think about it as your next of kin, where your loved ones are the ones that are making important decisions about your health because they know you best and they know your values best. Or we have tools like representation agreements and advanced directives so that when we're capable, we can decide who gets to make decisions for us and what those decisions might be. And all of those tools have no legal authority once you're under the Mental Health Act. So even if you appoint someone who knows you well, or you, while you're capable, you are like, you know, this one medication I have terrible side effects on, I really don't want to be put on that medication again. The act essentially removes the legal authority of all of those things. And the treating staff and the treating doctor essentially gets all the power over what's happening to you. And so that's another area where I think, you know, that approach in the legislation reflects deep stereotypes about people's capacity and about, you know, your right to have the people who know you best and your values respected. And we know there's ways to improve it. And we know that involving family is good for us. Like, it makes our care better and it makes our health better. So those are a couple of examples. I could give you more examples, but I won't. I feel like they're all long and hard to explain.
And I'm sure, I mean, there's obviously a lot of territory that we haven't covered, but is there anything in particular that you think that I've missed that you'd like to mention?
I mean, I think the biggest thing that we are also really focusing on is the fact that, and I think we hear this a lot, but I think it's really central to Health Justice's work, is that the people who are impacted most by these systems need to be at the center of figuring out what the solutions are. And so, for example, I'm a human rights lawyer by training, and so we're talking about legislative reform. But we work really hard not to make assumptions that because, you know, I have access to legal training, that makes me an expert in these things, because I don't think that's the truth. And so I guess that's the other important piece, is I think it's really important to balance sort of momentum. And, you know, I think there's some really sort of shocking things in the act that need to be modernized and need to be modernized quickly. But I also think there's a real need to lift up and understand the ways that the act is impacting people with lived experience and Indigenous communities as a colonial tool when we think about what the solutions and what the, you know, thinking outside the box about what's possible, because I think we have a lot of assumptions about people, especially with people who might be experiencing what we consider like serious mental illness. I think for a lot of us, we just assume that, you know, being in the hospital in a psychiatric ward is kind of the best we can do for folks. And so I guess the only other sort of final thought I have is that I think we learn all the time from people with lived experience and from our Indigenous partners that we can do much better for folks and support their dignity and rights and their communities in a lot of ways in much more robust ways. And that it's really, really crucial that we're having those kind of fulsome conversations.
Yeah, fantastic. If anybody wants to get involved or they want to help support like Health Justice's work, where can I send people?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest spot is on our website. So it's healthjustice.ca. And all of our social media links and everything are on there. And you can sign up for a newsletter or anything else if you're interested.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much again for taking this time to speak with me, Kendra. This is awesome.
No problem. Thank you so much.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
Welcome back to On the Point by CITR 101.9 FM, your source of alternative and undercovered news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You just heard an interview with Kendra Milne, Executive Director of Health Justice, about the BC Mental Health Act.
So just a quick hit before we go. There was a tweet recently that said BC was the Florida of Canada because of the relatively laissez-faire approach the province has taken to restrictions. Some people thought that the author, Dr. Eric Fagel Dang at Harvard, was referring to general culture as well. It was a pretty petty Twitter fight, but what do you guys think? Do you think BC is the Florida of Canada?
I have opinions. Let's talk about them. So I think everyone got really annoyed about this tweet, which I found extremely hilarious. But also, people stopped talking about COVID response and they started talking about like general culture. People are saying, no, BC is closer to the California of Canada, which I don't know, maybe that is something you all agree with also, but I don't know. You know, it does have to be said that BC isn't doing well right now in terms of COVID. The rolling average of cases has gone up. Variant data is little to non-existent. But it's certainly not as bad as Florida, where, like, the governor, like arrested the woman who was, like, reporting about COVID deaths or something crazy like that. So, like, I don't know. I would not go as far as to call. Strictly in terms of COVID terms, I'm talking about general culture, which is a whole other can of fish. Just strictly talking about COVID response, I don't think it's as bad as Florida. But then that's pretty much the Canadian response to anything, but that is my stance on this.
Yeah, I think that the somewhere of somewhere else, like, equivalencies are always really ham-fisted and kind of unnecessary, but I along with the California of Canada or whatever thing that you've heard. I'm from Maui originally, and I've heard that BC is the Hawaii of Canada, like, more times than I can count, which just sits very strangely for me always. I think the only comparison there is, like, the weather's kind of warmer, but whatever. So yeah, I think this is just another one. I think that the, like, any cultural connections that are drawn are going to be pretty pretty abstract and unfounded anyways, but yeah, I think as far as, like, a scathing critique of the lack of response of the BC government to COVID in the last, like, well, at least 6 months especially, sure, why not? If it lights a fire of some kind, if it gets some sort of reaction, then why not? Let's go with the Florida of Canada, but I don't think it's very useful beyond that, so...
Yeah, I think this is very interesting because, like you pointed out, like both of you pointed out, most people are probably going to get caught up in the cultural conflict over whether BC and Florida are similar just as, like, a society. But the real issue here is, like, what is their actual impact and how are they doing in their COVID responses? And I don't know too much about what Florida's current response to the pandemic is like, but I know that for BC, like, earlier on, there was a lot of praise going around about how our province was responding. And now, you know, that's really changed over the course of now 1 year in almost to this pandemic. So I think that's really the key point that's worth looking into, which this tweet, I think, was trying to highlight, but kind of got muddied a little bit by the Florida comparison.
Yeah, I think the tweet was... like, within the context of the tweet, what he was really trying to address is that, like, masks aren't technically mandatory, and, like, how the responses in schools is, like, problematic, and that there isn't a lot of, like, clarification, and there's a lot of speculation amongst, like, parents, and they kind of have to do this, like, underground kind of network kind of thing instead of having that transparency. Though I understand for privacy reasons, it also is concerning, I'm sure, for parents. And then another thing, I just did some Googling, and this is, like, on a different point of view. I think there might be something to the claim if we look at this survey. So according to an Insights West, this is on CBC, according to an Insights West survey, basically... British Columbians are suggested to be the worst in Canada at following COVID-19 rules all the time. And so if you are looking at that aspect, I can see where that comparison to Florida comes from, because Florida is, like, kind of the symbol of basically, like, wildness and, like, yeah. Thoughts?
I mean, the caveat obviously is that survey was asking how likely are you to follow restrictions or something along those lines. And
yeah.
So it wasn't like a scientific thing that showed that, you know, so you know, that's the caveat there. And yeah, I would not be surprised actually considering two things, which is like we have relatively good weather. So like people are more likely to go out and completely disobey health restrictions. And also like, I do think there are like a certain number of just people who don't care about laws in this place, in the same way that a place like California or quote unquote liberal states in the US have a particularly stick in the ground sort of reactionary. I think those same sorts of people are also here. And we talked about this off air, but there was, you know, there was a huge thing recently about a bunch of flat earth guys just having a good time at a Vancouver condo. You can read more about that later. We're not going to get into it. But yeah, I do think those two things, the sort of the good weather and just general sort of lackadaisical attitude, and also the sort of very set deep stick in the mud reactionary might be a cause for it. I don't know. I'm not a sociologist, but that's just my completely unfounded opinion.
Yeah, I mean, this is like unscientific or unprofessional, but I'm, for one, like I personally am very frustrated with how long this pandemic is going. So I can understand where it comes from, that frustration, but also like I can understand it's for the greater good of like basically society that we stay home and we wear masks, you know, out of like empathy for other people who might be at risk more than ourselves. So,
yeah. I guess I can also see just like kind of expanding on the idea that like in BC we have slightly more temperate like weather conditions, and like I'm assuming more like bigger outdoor spaces that people just kind of like wander around at will. Like even early pandemic, I remember speaking with a lot of friends who were like just kind of around the world, and the idea of going out and like walking around a park was just like unheard of during a lockdown, whereas like I felt like that was pretty commonplace here and still is. So like I don't know, maybe there is just something to that, like, well, when you're already sort of bending certain rules and restrictions, then there's maybe the tendency to like take a lot of them a little bit more loosely. Not to say that I don't want to still be able to go out and like walk around in parks, but I guess if I have to give some credence to this Florida comparison, that's about where I can, yeah, where I can sign on for. But
yeah, and a thing that also is brought up later in the tweet thread is that BC is like a reproduction number, also called the R number, which is essentially I can't explain it, but it's essentially how fast the virus is spreading from person to person, essentially, is pretty high. But that is also unscientific because the province doesn't release data very well in order to for you to calculate an R number. So yeah, there's also that, I think, that sort of caveat in terms of Florida. But like, I don't know, I don't feel comfortable with calling BC the Florida of Canada, personally. But then again, I think that's such an absolute waste of time. But that's neither here nor there. That's why we're talking about it here on the show.
Whatever it takes just to get restrictions that work better or something, some action, some decisive action. If it means comparing us to Florida, then okay.
Yeah, and before we end, I do think another part of the frustrations is like the lack of clarity in kind of the restrictions. Like we're not really getting updates about like if this is changing, and so a lot of things are kind of blurry. And so like I know of cases where, you know, for like people don't need to leave their house or like go to places, but they're like, okay, I'll do this because blah 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 blah. And it's like, it's hard to like, if you pull up the list of the restrictions, it's hard to say that it's a black and white situation where it like 100% sure doesn't fall into, I don't know where I'm going with this, but point is the restrictions are really frustrating to navigate. And I'm sure a lot of people, I'm not like defending anti-maskers in any way, but I'm just saying like the restrictions themselves need to be more specific if we want people to follow them and try and like flatten the curve.
I would be interested to know like maybe a more helpful comparison between the two, like areas of BC and Florida would not be to compare their cultures, but rather to compare, like, how is their government, like, communicating their messages about the pandemic to the public? Because I think, you know, that's a really good point, that people are frustrated and not totally clear on what the restrictions really mean for them, like here in BC. So I wonder if something similar is happening in Florida, maybe with like a similar lack of clarity about, okay, how does this new policy or how do these new restrictions actually play out in my everyday life? Because if those things aren't clear, obviously there's going to be confusion, and obviously there are going to be then headlines about people doing ridiculous things that, you know, will warrant these kinds of cultural comparisons.
Yeah. And I think the last, we should probably end the show, but I think the last thing I would say is also like that something that Caitlin sort of brought up in passing is the calling a place the X of something when so much of our life is in this case federally, provincially, is so dictated by a government that has little empathy with the rest of its population, that to paint with a broad brush entire populations and, I don't know, call them all sorts of things, whoever, is completely ignoring the fact that this crisis was not their doing. You know, it's the people dying aren't, it's not an equal fight that we're fighting. So, you know, if you want to compare John Horgan and Governor, I think Ron DeSantis of Florida, then we can have a proper discussion about this. But like, yeah, these sorts of broad stroke cultural weird critiques do nothing and obfuscate the role in which government and institutions play in our lives, especially when it comes to pandemics. So I think we should end it there. I think that's a good note to end on.
So that's our show today. You just listened to On The Point, CATR's news show. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 p.m. for more local news. Stay tuned for more great CATR programming.